friends. Thank you so much for joining us yet again for another episode of What Page Are You On? It me, Bethany Rutter, and I'm here with my good friend and business partner.
It me, Alice Slater.
And we're very, very hyped to be joined today by the internet's favourite. It's only you, Eliza Clark.
Hello.
And not just the internet's favourite, but the real world's favourite. But I feel like you are truly excelling at the internet and have been for some time. How are you today, Eliza?
I'm okay. I'm sort of in the middle of tour-y kind of stuff, so I'm a bit tired, but not necessarily in a bad way. Tired and like I've been busy, I've been doing stuff, I'm feeling good kind of way.
Tired but wired.
Tired but wired, yeah.
Yeah. So the reason that we are chatting to you is because you have very, very recently had a book out, which is Penance. Would you like to kick us off by telling us about Penance?
Yes. So Penance is a slightly complicated book to sum up. And I haven't quite worked out my elevator pitch for it yet. But Penance is the story of three teenage girls who murder another teenage girl who they go to high school with, told in the style of a true crime book. But it is not true. It is made up. And maybe even within sort of in-universe, bits of it are made up. if that makes sense. Does that work?
Yeah, that works. So my first question, I just want to know, in terms of like the timeline of creating Penance, when was it written in relation to Boy Parts? Because I know that Boy Parts came out in like 2020. Right. So we've had like a 3-year gap. Did you end up writing it under the internet hype, or was it actually like before Boy Parts like really kicked off?
No, it was sort of partially written under internet hype. So Boy Parts came out in 2020. I sort of had signed the book deal for that in mid 2019. And then because I signed a 2-book deal, started writing a second book, but sort of in part because I had to. And then I didn't write a great deal at the end of 2019. I also didn't write a great deal during 2020, which was obviously both when lockdown happened and when Boy Parts came out, and particularly in that time period, not as much now. Leaving my flat and going to cafes to write was like the only thing that sort of made me have a process. So I kind of, for a long time during lockdown, I kind of couldn't really write because I just kind of completely lost my like space that I write in.
Yeah.
And then I think the sort of proper hype for Boy Parts didn't really kick off until like TikTok kind of got hold of it in 2021. At which point I had made much better like strides on Penance. So I think it was like sort of, I remember it being kind of like my sort of September, October 2021 royalty statement, where I was kind of aware very much of the sort of tangible effects of the TikTok stuff, where it was obviously you get like a breakdown of the amount of books that you sold. And it was a bit like, what the fuck? because it had kind of, like basically when you kind of bring a book out, you expect that to be like a gradual tail off, and I'd had this sudden jump, which was really, really weird. But it didn't really, I think because I'm not on TikTok and I therefore have not really seen and have quite intentionally not engaged with the sort of hype there, I wouldn't say that it hugely bled over into the process, but it was something that I was definitely like aware of. But also I think in some ways Penance is like a way less like controversial book than Boy Parts. I don't know if controversial is the right word, but there's like a lot of stuff in there which I feel like you would just be less likely to read Penance and be like, that must be her opinion, which is sort of a lot of the vibe with Boy Parts sometimes.
People just think you are Irina.
Yeah, which is really weird.
Good way to read that book, man.
Yeah. It's the kind of, it's very like, oh God, I don't know, to grow up. but yeah, I think there's like, there's much greater, like, I think you would have to be really, really like, I don't even know how you would kind of I think there are bits and bobs which you might think are sort of my opinion from Penance, or my one of my takes or personality traits or whatever. But yeah, it's overall it just I was kind of less worried about it anyway because I'd already sort of brought out this very like book that people could easily take in really, really bad faith. So
I guess one of the ways that you achieve that with Penance is by having the framework of the narrator being a older male journalist. How did you settle on that as like the point of view through which you are telling the story of Penance?
Yeah, I hadn't quite settled on who the narrator was until quite late in the process, comparatively. I'd gotten like a good chunk of the draft down before I'd actually quite decided who he was. And even within that, I was kind of like, I initially wanted the voice to be quite neutral. And I'd been reading a lot of, I reread all of Brian Masters' true crime books for Penance. So that was the kind of voice I was aiming for, that sort of very like neutral, authoritative, like empathetic. But I think that was just something about like the actor trying to like mimic that way of speaking that made it very, what's the word I'm looking for? Yeah, like it was quite pompous. It sounded quite pompous. So it was sort of dealing with that. And then I think once I had maybe settled on, oh, he just is pompous, that was a lot easier. There were also sorted out like a bunch of logistical issues with the book in terms of kind of the sort of moral or lack of morality of the narrator kind of really helped me deal with like the logistical stuff of like, oh, how does he have like access to like first person accounts and stuff like that. Yeah, so I think it was sort of late 2021 that I settled on that. It was sort of after I read In Cold Blood and did a lot of reading about Capote and about his kind of relationship with the truth, that I was able to kind of settle down more firmly on who he was.
And what, in terms of like developing the backbone of the book, the question that I keep getting that I want to ask you is, what's your relationship to true crime? Like, wait, are you a true crime imbiber?
Yeah, I sort of am / was. Like, I definitely, my relationship with it has changed a lot while writing Penance. And that now it's kind of like, I'm still quite happy to read like well-written true crime books. I actually think they're quite important for like highlighting these sort of social histories that you often wouldn't normally get to see in non-fictional fiction. Like, for the most part, non-fiction is kind of written about people who've done something extraordinary. Like they've climbed Mount Everest, or they were the first person to do something, or, you know, they're a big kind of political deal or something like that. Whereas I think true crime is sometimes the only nonfiction media that really gives you like a look into the lives of like very ordinary people who, granted, have often had those lives like upturned by something really, really extraordinary. But at the same time, it's the podcasts for me, I suppose, is where I'm at with it. In terms of where I've kind of fallen out with it a bit, where I think once you've read quite a lot of like well-researched and like good true crime books that do sort of go out of their way to kind of present a social history and talk about the systemic issues that led to a crime and the kind of overarching sort of societal stories behind these terrible things, that when you go to like some dudes basically just reading a Wikipedia page and then collecting their ad revenue, it just sort of becomes kind of unlistenable, I think, especially the sort of jokey, lighthearted tone. I don't know. I just kind of can't really stomach it anymore. I think it didn't used to bother me, but now it does.
Like that. Is it the actual opening? Is it the first bit?
Yeah. Kiss on your grave.
It's just so awful. It's such an awful title. It's perfect.
But it was so accurate. Like reading that, I was like, this literally, like, she's done such a good job of doing this genre of podcast. But yeah, I feel like maybe we are, you know, obviously I've talked to Alice about this in the course of her releasing Death of a Bookseller, but I feel like we're possibly like in the same place regarding like all of our relationship to true crime. Like the tolerance for it has decreased in proportion to the number of like substandard podcasts that have appeared weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The sort of Netflixification of it all. I think the post Netflix stuff has made it really like just a lot of very bad documentaries that have come out as well recently.
So like The Rise in My Favorite Murder, I think really like changed the course of the way the conversation was, like combining, you know, true crime with comedy, I guess. Mm. They're not natural bedfellows.
It's like I sort of understand the kind of like the sort of gallows humor stuff, and I think to a degree there's a place for that, but I think the place for that is maybe like historical cases where there aren't living victims and living families of victims. I often find that with the American ones as well, I feel like the second they're dealing with cases that aren't in America, just there's a level of respect that's immediately just gone in a way that's sort of really tacky. Feels very sort of, oh, I don't know, just very like American centric, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Agree. But I feel kind of similar that I still have like an interest in reading like interesting nonfiction about, or like, yeah, I think if it's got like an investigative angle or like is a well-written nonfiction account, I'm still like in, I'm still up for it. So it has to be of high nutritional value and to actually teach me something rather than just like excavating someone's unfortunate situation.
Yes, I think that's sort of ultimately, yeah, I think it's stuff that you can like learn something rather than just kind of feeding like a bit of a kind of prurient impulse to consume horrible information, I suppose.
On that, you know, vaguely that note, are there any kind of real life cases that you had, you know, not necessarily like directly were trying to mirror, but like that you had in your mind as like had the elements that you felt you wanted to deal with in Penance?
Yeah, the case that Penance is probably closest to is the murder of Shonda Shara, which was in the early 90s in the States, which I kind of sort of intentionally didn't research in a lot of ways because I didn't want it to be too close to the Shonda Shara murder. So I started reading a book about it, which is Cruel Sacrifice by, I want to say, Aphrodite Jones as the writer. And yeah, it was just sort of like I knew if I read too much about it, I was going to take too much from it. So I decided to kind of lean back from it a bit. And to a lesser extent, the murder of Suzanne Capper, which was also in the early 90s, but it was in the UK. And the Suzanne Capper murder pretty much coincided with the Jamie Bulger trial and was also in Merseyside. So it got very, very little press attention. So that was where I was also sort of interested in this idea of something getting very little press attention because of something else happening at the time. Because Penance has ended up being set during the Brexit vote. But it was sort of, there were a couple of different places where it almost went. I think the Olympics was like the sort of main place where it almost went.
Changing the subject slightly. Obviously we on the pod, we've met on the internet, and so we really loved the kind of Tumblr element that exists within Penance. We'd love to know a little bit more about your teenage relationship with the internet.
Yes, well, I was on Tumblr, unfortunately, from 2009. So I was like a relatively early adopter of it. And I was a very, very heavy Tumblr user. I was in fandom spaces. I was not in true crime fandom spaces. I think that was something that was like, that wasn't even something that I was particularly like voyeuristically interested in. It was almost something that I intentionally gave a wide berth. I think probably because I did listen to like true crime podcasts and stuff, you sort of want to have a bit of a like, almost a bit of like, oh well, I'm not like that. So I just very much kind of kept away from it. But no, I was much more into like, I guess like quote unquote normal fandom spaces. So I was like writing fanfic and just kind of like a poster. And then as I got a bit older, I shifted into being a bit more of like a, I guess kind of like a fashion makeup aesthetic kind of space, but like still with a bit of that kind of like fandom nerdy comedy stuff. I don't know, it was a bit of a blog for all seasons, I suppose.
Yeah, I didn't even know about the true crime fan fiction side of Tumblr until I read the Rachel Monroe book Savage Appetites.
Yeah,
and it blew my mind. I was like, what the fuck.
Yeah, I was like aware of it as something like people just that people dunked on, but to an extent, I like wasn't really sure how like real it was. I think especially because a lot of the people who operate in those spaces are very like irony poisoned, where they're sort of in that space where it's like I don't really like I'm like photoshopping a flower crown onto Jeffrey Dahmer is like a joke, but also kind of not really,
I'm
which
still
is where
doing
it is, yeah.
it. Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. It's like everything's just completely doused in irony and a vague desire to elicit sincere responses from people.
Yeah, but yeah, it's interesting that you name check Savage Appetites there, because that did end up being like a really kind of key text for Penance in the end. I think I've like name checked it in the bibliography, because it was there is like a very short bibliography at the end of Penance, because that felt very like just very important for it.
Yeah, same with me though. Savage Appetites, I think, was one of the most influential books that I read. My old novel.
Because obviously that's something that gets specifically referenced in Penance is the Lindsay Suvannavejh case, which I think you do refer to by name in that. And Savage Appetites was the first time that I encountered that as a thing. But obviously that's like deeply like intertwined with like Tumblr true crime spaces that I feel like you also captured like that really well in the book, just reproducing the way that people speak. And yeah, I feel like as a kind of fictional document of like very niche internet things and behaviors and spaces, I felt it was like so on. Like I loved it.
Yeah, and like I feel like from the Rachel Munro book, and then later on, the sort of podcast series that I listened to, which is like a series of interviews with her. Like, I'm not sure if this is a false memory, but I feel like I remember the Lindsay Suvannavejh stuff happening. On and specifically, I feel like I can remember people talking about it in a kind of like, what the fuck? Look at this stuff that they're doing over there kind of thing. And yeah, I think it's like, I don't know, it just feels like a bit of quite a like Wild Westy place. I think Tumblr did have a bit of a weird Wild Westy kind of quality, especially as the internet was becoming more like more that kind of web 2.0, 3.0 space where it was like a lot of moderated social media websites instead of just sort of like mad forums and like these sort of tighter kind of spaces. Tumblr did have a bit of a weird kind of insular quality that reminded me a lot of like earlier internet stuff.
And look what happened to it when they tried to be mommy and daddy. Like, who is even on Tumblr anymore? Like, overnight, it
Yeah.
became a different beast.
Yeah, I actually heard from people who sort of stayed on there that it actually became a lot more pleasant. Because a lot of, because there was a bit of a mass exodus, it was just sort of like weird old guard people who just kind of wanted to stay on because that's where all of their friends were. And then it was, and then Twitter got much worse. But I think that might be a bit of a false sort of, I think Twitter's always been bad.
So obviously we've kind of covered this slightly at the beginning, but I'm really interested in, you as an author, like how do you write with the kind of implanted like thought of like people reading your receiving your work in like a boring puritanical way, or are you kind of like desensitized to it by now?
I'm a little bit desensitized to it. And I think to an extent, I kind of never really cared in that, like, I just feel like I think because Boy Parts sort of came out in the same year as My Dark Vanessa. If you remember, there was that really terrible sort of bad faith accusation made against Kate Elizabeth Russell. And that kind of like that did quite scare me a bit. I think especially that was coming relatively hot off the heels of Melissa Broda being forced to apologize for fiction crimes in the Pisces and stuff.
I completely missed the Melissa Broda thing.
Yeah, it was, if I recall correctly, it was a lot of people were upset that, not to do Pisces spoilers, but basically an animal dies in the Pisces. And I believe she was made to apologize for that in public, which is very kind of the sort of
Girl.
thing I think one's publisher should not have one's authors doing.
Not man, because it implies that you won't do it again, and it's like fucking might do. You
Yeah.
know what I mean?
But yeah, that I may have misremembered that, but
I'm
I'm
gonna be.
pretty sure that was real. So it's sort of like, I don't know, I was kind of like, I was like very anxious about it in the lead up to Boy Parts being published, but it wasn't something that I thought about, because you sort of, you think of people who are kind of very puritanical and bad faith as like a very small minority, and I think they are. But I suppose that the problem is that they are a vocal minority. And I think sometimes, particularly when you couch this kind of outrage in the language of social justice, people can take it more seriously than it is perhaps due to be taken. So it was sort of like, I don't know, it's almost like sometimes I think there is a bit of a positive to having like Tumblr brain on, where I feel like I can kind of circumvent and think about the worst possible way someone will take something. So I do always feel like I kind of got an answer for it. But I feel like I just didn't think about it so much with Penance, because I just think that like, I feel like I didn't really think about it with Boy Parts. I suppose it's more of like a run-up to publication thing that it worries me rather than while I'm writing.
I feel like I definitely was worried about what I was doing with Death of a Bookseller. And during the editing, the first kind of edits, I read Boy Parts. Oh no, it probably wasn't edits actually. I was probably still working on it. I read Boy Parts and I was like, fuck it. If she can write this, then my characters will be okay. I won't get murdered by the puritanical
mom. I mean, I think for the most part, people know that they're reading fiction. And for the most part, people are fine and they're happy to sort of experience it as fiction. It's just like I said, I think there is like a vocal minority out there that's like, oh, this is clearly the author's opinion. But I feel like if that's ever taken to you, which it hasn't really ever been taken to me, I just feel like there's just a very easy response to it, which is just like, I don't know. I think that's like some of the jokes, or I guess like quote unquote jokes in Boy Parts that people think are like reflective of my opinion in some way, where you can just kind of be like, well, why would that be reflective of my opinion if you can accept that like I don't think like sexually abusing men is okay? Like if we can all sit down and agree that the author definitely doesn't think that's okay, why would I be endorsing like one of the jokes she was making or something like that? Do you know what I mean? Which obviously I do endorse all of the content in Boy Parts.
Yeah, depiction is endorsement.
Yes, it is. In my case, it 100% is. Kill your friends. That's my take.
So I wrote this question, and I think it's Alice's turn to ask a question, but I'll ask it because in case I didn't write it in a very coherent way, so I can be responsible for the question asking. Speaking of kill your friends, when I was reading it, I had this sense that like all of the relationships were so shifting, but also had all of the like extreme emotions that come with being a teenage girl, that I had this sense that any of them could have been the victim and any of them could have been the aggressor by the end of it. Do you think that that is like a legit assessment of the way that the power dynamics worked in Penance?
Yeah, absolutely. Pretty much. I think it's sort of this case of almost a bunch of people kind of whipping each other up into potentially doing something. And I kind of touch on it in the book, this idea of like play spaces and the crossover from play spaces into real life. And to a degree, I think teenagers' sort of difficulty and lack of understanding of permanency and the impulsiveness that comes with being that age. That, yeah, I really do think, I think teenagers are just so plastic in some ways, that there's like, I don't know, I feel like there's almost real potential for you to do anything when you're kind of young and vulnerable like that. And that was something I was definitely really interested in exploring in Penance, the sense of like, it went wrong in this particular way, but there are so many other ways it could have potentially gone wrong.
So you dropped like the we had a bombshell recently with the Boy Parts stage adaptation at the Soho Theatre. Tell us everything.
Yeah, I think something that's funny, but it's just because I've been like quite busy with I'm working on the TV adaptation for Boy Parts, which hasn't been greenlit yet. So nobody freak out who's listening potentially, but I've been working on that, and then I've been working on like some other bits and bobs of TV projects. A wonderful thing about working in television is that you can write and get paid, and often nobody has to read or see it, which is great. It works really well for me. But yeah, with the stage play, because I was kind of so wrapped up in it, I almost like, I feel like I forgot to tell like anyone. Like I forgot to tell my parents it was happening.
I was like, like, this must have been under such a strict NDA, because like no one's known about it.
No, it's the only NDA was the NDA in my brain where I just forgot about it. But no, it's really, really exciting, despite my sort of sim. It came together really quickly as well. So I think they first chatted to me about kind of taking it in like December of last year. So it's been quite a like quick thing. And I think because they're doing it as a one-woman show and it's going to be mostly using the text from Boy Parts, the book, I'm looking forward to it coming together. I'm going to be hovering in rehearsals and sitting there every single night when it's on in the front row and standing up and telling people to clap.
Like normal.
Yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to it. It's so cool. It's kind of crazy that it's just like, it's just going to happen. They're just going to do it.
It's going to feel like very strange to me as someone who's a big fan of the audiobook, which you read yourself. Mm-hmm. It's going to be really strange hearing these lines, but like from a different mouth.
Yeah, it will be. I think I'm quite interested because I actually recently listened to the Penance audiobook, which I really struggle to like read my work back once it's done. To the point that particularly if I had a break to the point that I kind of struggle with my line edits sometimes because I just kind of end up doing like loads of fiddling with it if I'm looking back at it. So I kind of struggle to like read it again, like as in to sort of physically sit down and read it again because I'm just kind of like line editing in my head. But I listened to the Penance audiobook, which I notably don't read. We have a cast of six for that, which is really, really cool. I was sort of able to enjoy it, which is kind of a wild and new thing for me and my own work, and that I feel like I kind of can't enjoy it after a certain point, which is usually the point where I've kind of like handed it in and done my own edits on it. After that point, it just sort of becomes like a bit of a source of anxiety for me. But I think, I don't know, I'm quite excited for seeing if the Boy Parts play allows me to enjoy Boy Parts again, because there have been points where I've been working on like the TV adaptation and having to refer back to the book for scripts and almost just like holding it at like an arm's length and being like, oh god, when I'm trying to read it. So hopefully maybe it coming out of somebody else's mouth will make it a fun and enjoyable text for me again.
Have to report back, man, let us know.
Yeah. Have you read anything recently that you're like excited by and want to tell us about?
Yes, I'm doing that classic thing of, because I've got a book coming out, I've read like four things this year. But I've read Yellow Face by R.F. Kuang, which I'm mentioning at every point because it's sort of it is one of the four books that I've read this year, but I just feel like it's such an easy recommendation.
That's a banger.
It's so good. It's just that I really like a well-executed monologue, just one woman being crackers for a solid 400 pages, which, you know, that was just, it's just great. It's so easy to read. And I mean that in like just such a like positive way, in that like, it's like really that voice is so complex and so clever. And that character's so multi-layered, and everybody in Yellowface sucks as well, which I think is so fun. It's quite rare to get a book where like the entire principal cast is just everyone's a dickhead. So I really enjoyed that. In terms of good true crime, I read Francisco Garcia's We All Go Into the Dark, which is sort of almost kind of, it's a book about the Bible John murders, but it sort of ends up almost debunking the existence of Bible John. And I think it's a kind of like what I was saying, sort of an important true crime book for presenting a social history of Glasgow in that era, but also kind of talking about the kind of storification and the easy narratives that people can latch onto with terrible crimes like this, which I think it's just very, very sensitively done and a very interesting piece of work, particularly if you're interested in the idea of like these sort of unsolved murder cases all being kind of clumped together with one potentially fictional serial killer behind it. And so I completely think Bible John's like a complete fabrication of the media now. Same with the Zodiac Killer. I don't think that's real either.
Interesting. Oh my god.
But yeah, I would definitely recommend it. It's really, really good.
Okay, Bethany wrote this question, and now it's going to seem like I'm asking a leading question. But so other than my book, which is also true crime related, what would you recommend to readers who enjoy penance?
Oh, other than Death of a Bookseller, which I feel like does feel like the most obvious kind of.
I mean, you are allowed to say, you are
exactly,
allowed.
That's why I wrote it in the question. I was, you know, like, if I don't lead it, someone will lead it anyway.
I would really recommend Matt Wesolowski's Six Stories series, which is, I think you talked about it years ago on the podcast, where it's kind of made up of this sort of matrix of like podcast episodes. So it's like you get these like long point of view monologues, and those are really good. I think if you liked Penance, I would almost just say just go straight to Six Stories, because that seems like the most sort of obvious go-to. There I would probably recommend, in terms of other true crime, well, not that it is a true crime book, but I would probably recommend reading some true crime. So if you like Penance, maybe try The People Who Eat Darkness by Richard Lloyd Parry.
That's one of my favorite nonfiction books of all time. I think
it's fantastic,
amazing.
Isn't it? Yeah. It's so good. I feel like I'm not sure if I read it on your recommendation, or there's a producer I work with who really, really likes it. And as a couple of times he's been like, I've been trying to get the rights for that for years. And I can see
why. I hope
it
succeeds. So I'd love to see that. Have you read my other fave non-fiction crime book, The Sleep of Reason, about the
I was just gonna recommend that as well.
I'm glad, because I do, you know, I obviously, you've already mentioned the Jamie Bulger case, but I just think as like a high nutritional value non-fiction book that gives you a different perspective on something that has its own real like narrative, I just think is so eye-opening and mind-opening.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. It's just written with this kind of degree of like empathy and like genuine interest in unpacking the case rather than just kind of condemning it. And it gave me quite a like fresh perspective on it. I think like with a lot of true crime stuff, there are these sort of easy narratives that people get very attached to. And I think books like The People Who Eat Darkness and The Sleep of Reason go a long way to unpacking those and making those narratives less easy to deal with and less consumable, I suppose.
Okay, and our final question is, what's next? What's coming next, and what are you working on?
I'm working on some bits and bobs for TV and film, which, like I said, is mostly very likely to not see the light of day based on how the sort of film and TV industry generally works. But in terms of book stuff, I do have a short story collection coming out in November of next year, but I feel like I'm not really working on that so much because that was originally a bit earlier in the schedule. So I'm kind of a bit like done with that now. And then I have started working on a third book, which I'm not going to talk too much about just because, I don't know, I'm not a work in progress talking about girly. I just feel like I'm liable to either potentially scrap things or change a lot of stuff. And yeah, I don't know. Also, it's just if you mention a work in progress and then it never manifests, I think sometimes it's the ultimate form of cringe for a writer, surely.
I feel like every single detail I share, that ends up changing and I make a liar of myself.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It's just, things shift too. I'm so early on in the project as well that, but yeah, that'll be interesting. It's sort of, I'll say that it's kind of in sort of speculative fiction space.
Ooh.
So it'll be interesting to see what I do with that. Yeah, yeah. I've already decided I want to be one of the girlies that works in a different genre every single book. Just because, you know, my own interests are very eclectic. So I'd like my body of work to reflect that, I suppose.
Well, also, I can't
wait. Yeah, whatever you do, we're hyped for it.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much for joining us. We really wanted this, and I'm really glad that we made it happen because I, for one, enjoyed it, and I think our listeners will enjoy it.
Yes, I hope so. I've been listening to Wattpage for like years as well. I think I've said this to you before, but I remember that like when I was working on Boy Parts, I used to listen to Wattpage and be like, I wish I could have like an author interview on Wattpage you on. And now I've got an author interview on Wattpage you on.
And so much more. Not the peak of your professional success. Well, yeah, thank you so much. I'm sure penance will not be a new discovery for anyone that listens to What Page Are You On, but I hope it tips the scales if someone was like, oh yeah, I keep hearing about this and I haven't bought it yet, that this has confirmed that they should go out and buy it, because they will love it.
Yes, I hope so.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next time.
See you next time.
Bye.